been born with white skin, they explain, and the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain as he rises to fame, and the poor white remains on the caboose of the train. But it ain't him to blame, he's only a pawn in our game.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masterson. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Chris Parker, a professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington. He is the principal investigator of the Multi-State Survey on Race and Politics and the director of the Center for Survey Research at the University of Washington and the author of Fighting for Democracy, Black Veterans and the Struggle Against White Supremacy in the Postwar South. And his latest book just out is Change They Can't Believe In, the Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chris Parker.
Thank you, Ian. I'm honored to be here.
And clearly the IRS is on the defensive, and so is the White House, by the way, today in the press conference with the Turkish Prime Minister. The president once again went after the IRS and said how terrible it is, and we have to be completely nonpartisan at the IRS. And, of course, the acting head has been fired or is obviously stepped down under fire. It's a bit hard to understand why the president is being so defensive at this point, when in fact he could turn the whole thing around by pointing out that the IRS, in fact, hasn't done its job. It wasn't that they were doing too much, they were doing too little. These 501c4s have opened the floodgates for anonymous billionaires to pour millions and billions into our elections. And the IRS, basically, 90% of the applications have come from right-wing groups. So, you know, obviously they should have gone after Karl Rove, but I don't see the problem. Do you?
No, well, there is a slight problem in that, yes. I mean, it should be, the IRS should be, you know, politics-free. However, and it's a big however, the IRS went after the NAACP in 2004 because Julian Bond, the chairman at the time, he's now chairman emeritus, you know, spoke out against Bush policies, the war, the economy, and, you know, so on and so forth, right? So, you know, most people get audited, you know, after the IRS receives their taxes, but they got audited in October, which is an odd time. So so anyway, there's one example. Let me just call forth a couple other figures I think the listeners may be interested in. The first of which is there are about 296 potential political cases the IRS ended up with. That is to say, cases from the far right. Do you know how many were denied? I'm just going to ask you just a guess. I'll give you one educated guess. How many were denied?
Probably two.
No, zero.
There you go.
Zero.
Right.
Were denied, right? So there are 108 approved, 28 cases in which the application was withdrawn by the applicant, and there are 160 cases that are now pending. Now, I will hazard a guess that those will go through scot-free, given the current political climate.
Well, but I don't understand, and I'm certainly not defending the politicization of the IRS, because I think it, and we know that it started, at least the ones that I can remember were back in the Nixon days. He used the IRS against his political enemies, and nobody would defend that kind of behavior. But as an institution that are trying to fund the United States government, most of the anti-government activity in this country, the hatred of the government, the paranoia about the government, and the defiance against paying taxes for this evil government, they all repose in the far right, do they not?
Yes. So let me elaborate on that a little bit. Now, it's just my supposition here. I have done a little bit of research, but it's my supposition here that not only do these people just generally don't like government necessarily, but because you have a black man who is the head of government, that's an even bigger problem for them. So when we're talking about taxes, it's not just, you know, the state is redistributing my hard-earned money. It's this black man who has his hand in my pocket and who plans on redistributing it to black and brown people. So that it adds a little bit more impetus and urgency to their cause.
And your book, Chris Parker, Change They Can't Believe In, the brand new book that's just out here with co-author Matt Barreto, I guess makes the case that the Tea Party is not a revolutionary party, as it's been largely portrayed as in a benign way by both the left and the right-wing press, I would argue, going back to the idea that their roots come out of the outrage over the bailout on Wall Street, which for reasons that still mystify me, the political left in this country did not seize upon. But that's another argument. But I'm saying that what I get out of your new book is that the Tea Party is not a revolutionary party. It's a reactionary party.
Yes. That is very much so the case. So first of all, you know, some people want to make this argument, and I run into them all the time. Oh, yeah, the Tea Party, you know, they hated Bush, too. It's like the Tea Party did not exist on Bush's watch, right? It did not exist at all. Okay, let me just give you a few facts and figures about Bush, right? When we start talking about the deficit, for example, it expanded more than any other time in history. Oh, and we just found out this morning that the deficit has decreased. So projected decrease by $200 billion, right? We found that out this morning, right? So let me throw that on the table. Moreover, the increase in discretionary spending increased by a total of 49% on Bush's watch. Even if you compare Bush to Clinton, right, and looking at the federal government, on Clinton's watch, the federal government increased by 11%. On Bush's watch, it increased by 104%. Bush entered office with a $700 billion surplus, thanks to Clinton. He departed with a $1.3 billion deficit, which constitutes a $2 billion swing. TARP was initiated on Bush's watch, $700 billion bailout to GM, AIG, and Citigroup. So if conservatives were so upset, and the Tea Party claimed that they're really all about fiscal matters and small government, I ask you, where were they on Bush's watch?
Well, that's the point, though, isn't it? That, again, the point that you make in your new book, Change They Can't Believe In, Christopher Parker, co-authored with Matt Barreto, is that the Tea Party is just a repackaging of the far right in this country. You go back to the Know-Nothings, the Ku Klux Klan of the 1920s, and, as you just mentioned, the John Birch Society. I think that's a part of the brilliance of the Kochs and others, is that they've managed to make this look like it is something new when it is, in fact, something old and perpetually noxious.
Yeah, this sort of reactionary conservatism has been around for a very long time, as you mentioned. We tie it to the Know-Nothing Party of the 1850s, to the Klan of the 1920s, to the John Birch Society, and obviously to the Tea Party now. And what they all have in common is their definition of what a quote-unquote real American is, generally white, male, middle class and wealthier, older, Protestant, heterosexual. This is who the and it's riven, the social science literature is riven with this description, right? Both empirically and sort of thematically, right? That is who the real American is. And every time there's a threat, a possible sustained threat to this, you get one of these far-right reactionary movements that comes around because it's a reaction to what they perceive as rapid social change and that their America is being stolen from them, pilfered from them.
Well, but it seems to me, and I think in many ways Ronald Reagan, you know, and he's the darling of every conservative in this country, he appealed to that atavistic Ozzie and Harriet, June Cleaver era of black and white television that was really unreal to begin with. The only reason that we had white America then living this perfect American dream was that blacks and Hispanics were invisible. They were there, but they weren't shown. And what's happened since is that the rest of America, the other real Americans, they've gradually stepped out of the shadows. And is that what they can't deal with?
Yeah, it's that, but it's what Obama represents, right? Think about who the president is, you know, in American political life. We know, research has shown, we know who the president is from the time we're little kids. The president is an authority figure in our lives from the time we're little kids, right? He is not only the head of government, but the face of America, you know, beyond our shores, internationally. And so for a lot of people, for most of us, especially as we move into adulthood, our identity becomes connected to the presidency, because the presidency represents us all, right? So what happens then if you have someone in that position who no longer looks like you, right? It makes you paranoid. It makes you a little nervous that the commander-in-chief of the military is no longer a white man, right? The chief law enforcement officer is no longer a white man, right? The face of America is no longer a white man, right? That is a powerful symbol to these folks.
But what explains, though, Chris Parker, what explains why conservative America is happy with Condoleezza Rice, with Colin Powell, and they've got this surgeon, I can't remember his name now, this is the new champion of
Ben Carson.
There you go, yeah. So these people, and you got Clarence Thomas, for God's sake, on the Supreme Court. So,
yeah, but I don't think they, people really consider him to be black. But anyway, that's a different case.
Right, but if you could give me some insight into why it is that Obama scares the hell out of them and Ben Carson is a hero.
Okay, so let me clarify this. Let's make a distinction between more mainstream moderate conservatives and reactionary conservatives, right? Mm-hmm. So one distinction is that more moderate mainstream conservatives, when you think about these people, if you think about them like back in the 60s when we really started having, when we had this split in conservatives or in the Republican Party, so you had Rockefeller, you had Mitt Romney's daddy, Nixon on one side, right? And then you had Barry Goldwater on the other side, right? And so you had these more moderate mainstream conservatives. I mean, think about, if we think about what conservatives and Republicans did in the 1960s, right? You had more Republicans vote for civil rights legislation than you did Democrats. So let's get that out there right now. There are different types of conservatives, right? So more moderate conservative does not necessarily embrace change, does not necessarily want change, but they'd rather have evolutionary organic change versus revolutionary change, right? I mean, Edmund Burke wrote about this, you know, regarding the French Revolution, right? And then you have, and so they understand change is necessary. When you look at these reactionary conservatives, they don't brook any kind of change whatsoever. They actually want to go back in time. Moderate conservatives, they're okay with moving forward incrementally. These folks, these reactionary conservatives, they want to look back in time. They see social change as subversion of their social prestige. And so we have to go backwards in time. So I just wanted to get that out of the way. So let me answer your question, though, more directly. So why are they okay with, let's say, Condoleezza Rice?
How about Herman Cain? That's a better example.
Okay. They're more comfortable, you know, this is not going to be the most politically correct answer. Just so I want you guys to know that I'm black, too, so I think I got a little room to run with here. Herman Cain is one of those quote-unquote black folks who says and does all the right things and stays in his place. He's a known quantity, right? He's tied to the United States. Same thing with Colin Powell. One of the reasons why, you know, people are upset with Colin Powell now is that he won't stay in his quote-unquote place, right? Now he says what he thinks. And so he's sort of alienated from the Republican Party. As a matter of fact, he's on record as saying, I didn't leave the Republican Party. The Republican Party left me.
Sure, and he voted for Obama twice. So.
Yes, and he voted for Obama twice. Condoleezza Rice, I mean, she was in Bush's cabinet. And she did everything that Bush asked him to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, I'm saying that these people, if you think about Colin Powell back in the day, if you think about Condoleezza Rice, if you think about Herman Cain, these are quote-unquote exceptional black folk and that they are not recognized as being black because they align their political beliefs with the right, right? At least Colin Powell, not anymore, right? But they're quote-unquote, they're okay. As far as black folks go, they're the exceptional black folks who don't act like all the rest of the black folks. Now, for Obama, you know, first of all, he has roots in Kenya, right? His father was a Kenyan national, right? And so they see him as a sort of Manchurian candidate. In other words, the reason why they're so scared of Obama, one of the reasons is because they don't really know much about him. Number one, right? Number two, they have to gin up this paranoia in order to make this a battle of, as false as it is, between good and evil. They see him and everything he represents as evil. And what I mean, everything he represents, look at what's happened to same-sex rights since he's been in office. They've gotten better, right? Look at what's happening to immigration reform. He gets in office. I know that was on the table in 2007. It was gone. He gets in office. He makes that a priority now in his second term because, quite frankly, Obamacare sucked up all the political oxygen when that went through. But now it's a priority, right? So you look at these groups who would be considered un-American, you know, gays and lesbians, Latinos, right? And it doesn't make a difference if they're natural born or illegal. They're both looked at in the same light, right? These groups' stature has risen collectively, right? But these are putative un-American or non-Americans as far as the phenotype is concerned.
Well,
so that's why we get these differences.
I see. So just in closing, Chris Parker, tell us about why you wrote the book, one, and two, and why people need to read it.
Happy to do so, Ina. Thank you once again for the opportunity. I wrote it because, I mean, I really wasn't going to write another book. I just, you know, received a major award for my first book in 2010, and then I just happened to be in the right place at the right time. And let me tell you what happened, Ian. So I put a survey in the field in early 2010 as a post-tenure project because my next book, the book actually I'm working on right now, is on patriotism. And I think you guys will like the way that's going to end up, too. But anyway, so it was intended to capture attitudes and beliefs towards patriotism. And by my colleague Matt's suggestion, he said, hey, man, why don't you just throw a question about the Tea Party on there? And I was like, okay. And that's what I did. So one day I'm sitting around with my dog Daisy, and I'm reading the New York Times and what Frank Rich is saying about, you know, them being, you know, just angry and mean and spiteful and kind of crazy, right? And then in the next couple of days, I read a piece by Peggy Noonan and a piece by Juan Williams in the Wall Street Journal who are saying the exact opposite, saying they're just angry, but they're just like everybody else. And so I'm like, you know what? I got data on this. Let me go check this out. And that's where it all started. That's where it all started because I tried to get an empirical handle on this, and no matter what I tried to do, right, methodologically, the connection between support for the Tea Party and these racist, these homophobic, these xenophobic, and these sexist attitudes continue to come together and they maintain themselves. And so I had to go deeper and get more sophisticated statistically, and relationships maintain themselves. And so that's what I had to do. So I felt like I had to write it at that point. Not only that, Ian, I had traveled with my then wife to Lanai. Now, if anybody who's traveled to Hawaii knows that Lanai is perhaps the most remote island. You got two restaurants on that whole island, right? We just happened to be sitting at a table, unbeknownst to us, of Tea Party people, and they start in on me. Where did Obama come from? Is he real, right? Or is he fake or what? And I used to run into people like that all the time at the airport, Ian, or if I'm just at a restaurant. And I just said, you know what? I really got to finish this book. So they continued to motivate me. So that's number one. So that's why I wrote the book. Why I think folks should buy the book, I think it because, like I said, it is the most rigorous examination of the Tea Party to date, and that will probably ever be. I do, and my colleague do, as much as we can to falsify our arguments, right? To say that, okay, maybe this isn't true. Maybe there are competing explanations for what we're finding, like conservatism, party ID, authoritarianism, and so on and so forth. But it's not there. There's always this relationship between Tea Party support and these intolerant attitudes towards the president, towards sexual minorities, towards racial minorities, right? It's all there. And so this will be, and it's written in a very accessible fashion. So one does not have to be statistically literate to understand what's happening in the book, because we put all the fancy tables and charts in the appendix in the back of the book. So the sophisticated lay reader will understand everything that's going on. So you're going to get the latest and best research on the Tea Party, and I doubt that anyone else will surpass this anytime soon.
Well, Chris Parker, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you, Ian. Thank you for the invitation and opportunity.
Again, I'm speaking with Chris Parker, who's a professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington. He is the principal investigator of the Multi-State Survey on Race and Politics, director of the Center for Survey Research at the University of Washington, and author of Fighting for Democracy, Black Veterans, and the Struggle Against White Supremacy in the Postwar South. And his latest book, just out, co-written with Matt Barreto, is Change They Can't Believe In, the Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the most important story on the planet that's being overwhelmed at the moment by phony scandal.